Radio EcoShock.
Beyond radio airwaves, these words travel through a vast network of computers, undersea cables, coolers, and fossil fuel burning, including coal. They call it the cloud. Where is the cloud? And what does it cost the atmosphere and the environment? Is it becoming a new life form? What happens as artificial intelligence and Bitcoin mining succeed? According to years of study by Dr. Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate, the cloud now has a greater carbon footprint than the airline industry. A single data center can consume the equivalent electricity of 50,000 homes. And we are just getting started with a boom in server construction globally. Dr. Gonzalez is an anthropologist of cloud storage. He is a digital sustainability advocate. Stephen has published in Wired and Popular Science. He's appeared on ABC News, the BBC, and more. From MIT, Stephen just took a new position as a postdoctoral researcher with the Fixing Futures Research Group. That is at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. From Frankfurt, Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
Let's begin with the basics. What is the cloud?
It's a really good question, right? I think there are a few technical definitions of what it is, and I think there's also sort of a layman definition, and I tend to lean on the latter there. So for the average person who doesn't really have a grasp of the vast suite of technical systems that they're interfacing with on a day-to-day basis, you know, the cloud is pretty much everything that the internet touches. And so it includes your personal devices that you're using to access the internet, like your mobile phone. But it also includes these vast data transmission networks and undersea cables. You have these internet exchange centers that are packet switching all of the different data that make up the internet and make it happen. And then I think the part that for me is perhaps the most interesting is the places where data is processed and stored. And these are called data centers. You might have seen them. Also, server farms is another term that people use to refer to these. And essentially, they're vast warehouses that are filled with racks upon racks of computers. And these computers are performing calculations. They are storing information for us. They are maintaining and facilitating websites. They're essentially the engine behind everything. And without them, the cloud as we experience it would not be possible.
Google appears to have purpose-designed server buildings with a few human touches. Are all data centers futuristic like that?
Absolutely not. So, I mean, I think that there is maybe a tendency from movies now, and there's a lot of spy movies where you see a glimpse of this data center, and the data centers that these movies and films, and also the images that Google and so forth put out of their own data centers, they represent kind of the pinnacle of technological sophistication in these. But there are a number of data centers that are actually much more modest in design and scope, that lack the resources and technology to make them as energy efficient as have that beautiful aesthetic that you're starting to see. I mean, there's even a kind of cottage industry online of sort of data center photography, which is attempting to highlight the aesthetic beauty of these data centers and the kind of precision of how they're set up and so on, colorful or very pristine, austere, and white. But there are so many data centers that I have been to and set foot in that are actually sort of falling apart in some ways, you know, that there's a mess of cables everywhere, there's molds growing in parts of the data center that haven't been adequately cleaned. Some of these data centers are in basements of universities or libraries or other kinds of buildings, so not all of them are as sophisticated as you might think. And I think that's really important.
So you went to big data operations in several U.S. states, as well as Singapore, Iceland, and your native Puerto Rico. And as a professional ethnographer, you gained access into the holy of holies, really. How did you get that access?
Well, this is a great question, and I'm so glad that you asked it. Because, you know, data centers, as you might imagine, you know, just given what we've just discussed, right, the importance that they have in our society, for our civilization, if you want to put it that way, These facilities, many of them are highly secure facilities because all it takes is one person with a flash drive to introduce some kind of bug to the network that might hamper the operations of the facility, compromise the data of the many clients that that data center is serving, and the cost of such a disruption is really, really high. And so they're very highly secure places, and getting access to them as a researcher was a bit tricky. And one of the ways that I was able to achieve that was through persistence, through many attempts to communicate with different people within the organization, but also demonstrating some kind of technical capacity or at least being open to learning. And in addition to that, the most important was really to the ability to respect the privacy of the companies. And so in my studies, I do not name specific facilities. I do not name specific participants. I use pseudonyms to anonymize these the people that I learned from, who gave me so much of their time to really give me an insight into how these data centers are operated, how they're run, what the culture of this expert culture is really like. Also, doing the study at the time when data centers were maybe I started this project back in 2015 when there was less public interest in these facilities. And I think now that there's more public interest, it's a lot harder to do the kind of study that I did, because there's a lot more paranoia about what might be found and shared and so forth.
So in Aon and in your other works, you've written about the people of the cloud. You call them caretakers, almost sounds like caregivers, rather than technicians. Talk about their work lives and the culture there.
A lot of people, when they ask me about data centers, they want to hear about the technology, which is great and interesting, and they should learn about it. But the people are really crucial to this enterprise. And I think that there is a bit of perhaps a myth that some people have internalized, just because they think of this idea of progress and technology. And so they think that all these computers, these facilities basically run themselves, and there's no human input or human touch involved, or barely any. And to a degree, that is true, in the sense that there isn't a huge workforce for a facility that might be, you know, this massive warehouse where you could easily get lost and not be able to find somebody for hours if you don't really know where you're going. And that might be staffed by maybe a dozen or a couple of dozen of people, and even in one shift there can be less than a dozen, depending on the size of the data center and the particular shift. But that is all to say that humans are very much part of the story. And this industry tends to be very masculine in terms of who decides to work in a data center, who gets the skills. The skills come from a lot of different industries. Now, some data centers recruit ex-military because of the kind of sensitivity, the sort of like crisis mode, the ability to handle stress and pressure. These are things that data center companies are interested in their employees and in their personnel. So that creates a kind of atmosphere that's very masculine, and there's a transmission of expertise from one generation to another, and that's also really interesting to observe. You have the Gen Zs and the millennials like myself, who are sometimes lower in the totem pole in terms of the level of their rank, in terms of their technician rank, and you have these older, more sometimes cantankerous senior folks who, you know, are passing on this knowledge. And it's really interesting to observe that. But, you know, it's also really high stress. And there is a kind of monotony to sometimes the job, right? Because there's like a lot of walking around the data center, physically, you know, touching these computers and smelling for burnt cables, which is something I've seen and observed, listening for the sounds of fans before sensors tell them that something might be wrong with the cooling system or a specific server's onboard fan, or maybe the cooling is not evenly distributed. And some of these things require a human touch, a human presence, human senses. And it's really amazing to witness that, and also to find the ways that these technicians imbue their world with meaning, right? So some of the computers, some of the specific racks or computers sometimes get ascribed kind of like personality traits, right? And there's a certain, what I might call a mysticism that I've observed, you know, something like luck or magic, magical thinking that sometimes is in play, because the technical complexity is such that you might think you know what's going on, but there's so many moving parts, and sometimes things don't work the way that you might expect them to work. and you can't figure out why. And so this is where the luck and the kind of magical thinking comes in. So for me, it's been really amazing. It's been such a privilege to be able to observe that. And, you know, and I'm somewhat critical of these folks, but I'm also really sensitive to the work that they're doing. And it's really an unsung labor that is making all of our digital lives possible. There are these men, mostly men, who are doing this work, and I find that fascinating.
You say the cloud is a carbivore. Talk to us about the climate concerns.
In many aspects, you know, cloud computing is metabolic. You know, that's what I, the way that I frame it in my work is that there's a degree of metabolism that is associated with computational processes. And that plays out in data centers where you have a significant amount of electricity that is used by the computers themselves to process information, to store information. And in the case of artificial intelligence, that processing is intensified. And so there's a much higher footprint of electricity involved to actually process and store that information. Now, we can also say that these data centers require a lot of energy to cool them as well. And so in the early days of data centers, much of this cooling was done solely with air, right? So air conditioning using the kind of refrigeration techniques that we're really familiar with in our own homes, but on a kind of much larger scale using this equipment called computer room air conditioners to actually cool the data centers. And that was really electricity intensive. But in the late 2010s and the mid 2010s, really, you started to see a transition where, you know, there was a lot more awareness. Many data centers started to use other techniques to cool, namely the water, right? So water was a more efficient medium than air and also cheaper in terms of the cost of water versus the cost of electricity in many cases was cheaper. And so many of these companies achieved significant electricity savings by turning to water. But what that resulted in is the data centers, in 2022, it was the International Energy Agency said that data centers consume about 1% of the world's electricity, right? So that's a pretty significant amount, even though it doesn't sound like it. And that number is set to grow significantly as artificial intelligence is further adopted and scaled up and the infrastructure required to support it. Data centers are that infrastructure. And also, you know, it's important to put into perspective that data centers like are these facilities that, you know, are consuming this vast amount of electricity, sometimes the equivalent of a small city in terms of the electricity, right? That's not insignificant. And additionally, you have the water footprint of some of these facilities, right, is also comparable to a small town per day. You have, you know, 1 to 3 million gallons of water per day used in some facilities, and that's related to cooling and related to also sometimes to energy production and so on. But they are not innocent in that they do have a real environmental footprint. The desiccation of water supplies in the U.S. is also, you know, identified by the IPCC, the United Nations, as one of the key drivers of climate change is desertification, is the process of transforming an environment into a desert. And when we deplete the water supplies of a specific community or area, that intensifies this process of climate change. So it's not just carbon emissions that is a concern for the climate.
So why don't they just put all the computer farms in Iceland or northern Scandinavia and get free cooling?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really good question that was imagined as a solution for a long time, especially in the late 2000s and early 2010s. There was this sort of almost like a fantasy that we could just put all the data there and harness the planet's its affordances. Like the planet is providing, you know, this cool climate that can be used as sort of like a natural refrigerator, and that was what the imagination was. And in some ways, it was very successful to put some data centers in Iceland and parts in other Nordic countries. But the problem, and which is still a problem today, is the specific digital services that we use have different requirements of latency. And so latency is the delay, you know, between phone call, you know, when you're having an international phone call overseas like we are ourselves, you know, there could be a bit of latency. And that latency intensifies depending on the distance and you know, the geography of the undersea cables that are supplying these signals are also part of this. and it's really complicated and it's not very intuitive. So it doesn't necessarily mean that if you're 5,000, if you're 1,000 kilometers away, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's this much slower. So it's not a one-to-one. It all depends on the routing of the different cables. But that being said, many of these services, we as customers and consumers have become so accustomed to speed and rapidity, and we come to value that. And that value is so intense that we are not willing to have, you know, a 0.05 millisecond delay with latency for certain kinds of applications. Like, for instance, this was a big case when it came to gaming and online gaming, and there were people who were upset because the latency was giving other people an advantage. But that also plays out in the stock market, where you have people who are moving their base of operations, you know, maybe just 500 meter or like maybe even 100 meters closer to the stock exchange to gain a nano fragment of a latency advantage on a competitor. So yeah, latency is a huge issue, and this is why we can't just put all the data centers there. But also, you know, even if there is no carbon footprint, there also has to be a sufficient capacity to generate the electricity needed. And I think this is something that is also not discussed, right? Is, you know, you can have renewable energy from a renewable grid, but you also have to have sufficient electricity to supply the data centers. And so what we're seeing in Ireland, for instance, is that there's just so much demand for electricity that the grid cannot support, or is struggling to support that demand, where, you know, in Ireland about 20% of the electricity consumed is going to data centers. So, yeah, so that's just one example.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate. Do they have big data centers in China, and are they running on renewables?
China does have data centers, and for a long time, actually, until about, I think, 2019 or so, there was a bit of a cryptocurrency production boom in China, and that was because of this kind of lack of regulations and the cheapness of electricity, and many of those crypto mines were really dirty in terms of the energy or mix. But the government decided to crack down on those, and they have since mostly relocated to Kazakhstan, and now there's some in Iceland, and now they're moving to other parts of the world as well. But, you know, the Chinese do have, they have a significant amount of data centers, and sometimes data centers are also necessary, not only because you need storage, but because of the geopolitics of the internet, right? So, and what I mean by that is, you know, if you live in China, you have limited access to certain kinds of websites. And the same goes for being in the U.S. or being in the EU, that there are certain, there's even a geography of information that you can reach and websites and content. And that a lot has to do with the sovereignty of data, you know, where data is data secure enough, right? So there are security concerns that make it, you know, certain parts of the internet not accessible to people living in China that are security concerns of the Chinese government. And so there has to be the construction of more data centers within the nation state itself or in closer proximity to it where they have control over those kinds of operations. So that's part of the reason why there's also a lot of data centers there. But also because it's a marketplace, and there's a huge amount of competition, right? With and Huawei is one example of a company that has a lot of data centers, right, which is competing globally. So they exist, you know, all over the world. So I would say, they do have data centers. And in terms of their sustainability, I mean, I think for a long time it was sort of something like the Wild West, but that has changed because you know, like in Beijing, for instance, data centers that have a power utilization effectiveness of, you know, 1.2 are no longer permitted, right? So I think these kinds of, there is a sense that the environment does matter, but also the electricity capacity matters, right? Like they do not want to create a scenario where their power grid cannot support the growth. And I think that's especially important now with the advent of artificial intelligence and the kind of intensification of artificial intelligence-ready equipment in data centers.
For a while, big American tech companies promised to run on renewables or somehow make up for their carbon belching with carbon credits or something. Now, with the new administration in particular, all that seems to be out the window. There's a big race towards AI everything. What do you make of the billion-dollar schemes to build gas generators or even open up old nuclear plants as part of gargantuan data centers.
No, I mean, I find it very concerning for many reasons. I mean, I think that, yes, like, technically speaking, like, nuclear energy is renewable, but we have seen the consequences time and time again of failures, right? The consequences that cannot be reversed to the environment, the radiation that leaches into soils, water supplies, and everything, right? That this is not easy to shake if something does go wrong with these sites, right? And then there's also the issue of nuclear waste, of radioactive waste, and so on. And I think another important part to mention here is that nuclear power plants consume a similar amount of water as data centers to keep themselves sufficiently cool, in many cases, depending on their construction. But that tends to be the standard or norm. So I would also say that they're not necessarily more sustainable in terms of the water issue. That is, I think, probably the biggest issue with data centers now and AI going forward. Also, a concern from my perspective of there is this sense of hype or this sense of anticipation that artificial intelligence is absolutely essential, a necessary, inevitable. There's so many, I mean, billions of dollars invested in this industry. But in terms of the actual returns on this investment, we are not really seeing those on any kind of scale that is justifying these vast capital investments. And so my big concern is that the data centers, there's all this investment in constructing data centers, but we have seen in the history of data centers, many data centers that are constructed and then get dismantled, right? So there is also this hype around the data center providing a lot of jobs, which has just been proven time and time again not to be the case, and all of this investment in capital that might actually be temporary. And so that's the other concern that I have is that there, if more nuclear power plants are built or old one, defunct ones are reactivated, and then the AI boom becomes something like a dot-com bust or an AI bust, you know, that we saw in the early 2000s. That would be, you know, really devastating economically to a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, shortly after the Americans announced a $500 billion server farm project, then a Chinese company developed AI using older chips and less energy. There's also the fragility that comes from this whole quantum chip thing. It might reduce energy and cooling, although those chips need to be near absolute zero, even colder, minus 273 C or minus 459 Fahrenheit. That's amazing. So as you try to plot out this future that maybe threatens our future, do you expect there could be new developments that might shrink the risk, maybe shrink it a lot and make this work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly open to that possibility. I mean, I think as a researcher, I have to be both skeptical and critical, but also the point of doing the scholarship that I'm doing and communicating it to the public is, and also to these companies in some cases, is so that they can do things differently and try to make improvements, because we can't get rid of these data centers. We've become so dependent on them that it's unimaginable, cataclysmic even, to propose de-digitalization entirely, I think, at this point, without a vast restructuring of society. There is certainly a possibility that there will be some innovations that can change the game. I also think that there are different technologies that are on the horizon. I'm currently researching what I'll call more very low climate footprint forms of information storage that actually have a longer, that are related to technologies that we're very familiar with, like tape and, you know, more analog technologies like books. Storage is only part of the problem. It only solves part of the problem. But there are, for example, a lot of investments and research being done on the possibility of using molecular storage, so a kind of synthetic DNA that is based on the proteins, the very proteins that, you know, life is coded from. I mean, there are also these kinds of ceramics and optical, like 5D laser etched glass type technologies that have about 10,000 times the capacity of storage than, like, you know, a comparable digital technology today. And, you know, I think the advantage of these technologies that I'm proposing, which is something we haven't talked about yet, is that they are very durable and they can last for thousands of years potentially, if depending on, you know, how they're constructed and implemented. Whereas our digital systems, and we haven't really talked about this, is they are actually incredibly fragile from the perspective of this longer history. our solid state drives start to fail and have like errors and bit rot, you know, within 10 years of use, and the HDD drives even worse. And, you know, we have these ancient technologies like cuneiform tablets that are 6,000 years old that you can still read the information encoded on them. I mean, it's not as convenient or as dense, but, you know, it's just an example to say that, you know, there needs to be some innovation and rethinking radically what information is and how it can be stored. But yeah, it is possible in the future that the data center industry or these many different tech sectors will find a way to mitigate or cancel out the electricity consumption. But, you know, the International Energy Agency is expecting 2.5 to 3 to even 7%. The range is pretty intense, right, of increase in electricity use by 2030. And I would say that is concerning, because that will require a lot of also electricity infrastructure, as you pointed out. And how they will go about doing that is really a question that has not been satisfactorily answered yet.
We will be right back with more from Dr. Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Anthropologist Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate published the paper, "The Cloud is Material, on the Environmental Impacts of Computation and Data Storage." So now you're part of a team at Goethe University trying to map out new ways of understanding the future, hopefully before it kills us. What does the Fixing Futures research group do?
Yeah, so we are a collection of scholars from different fields. There are some doctoral students. There's also the principal investigators and postdocs like myself. We come from geography, sociology, anthropology, and science and technology studies, which is sort of a field that is really interested in understanding technology and science and their social impacts, but also the ways that they, also their histories and the politics of certain kinds of technology. So it's important for us to ask these questions. And that's what we do as a research group, and we're really engaged in a range of different topics, everything from, you know, using algae as a carbon sink technology to, you know, PFAS, so the forever chemicals and their future, you know, the future of finance and so on. There's so many different questions that we're asking together and individually, and generally what we want to do is to provide a nuanced picture of what is possible for the future, and to inform our fields, but also the wider public on what those possibilities are.
Well, I have a couple of huge questions with only a couple of minutes left, but we'll give it a shot. I know that you have said we also need speculative fiction to explore these complex problems. I mean, just to imagine it. And as a fiction author under the pen name E.G. Conde, you invented something called Tainofuturism. Does that allow hope in spite of everything?
So, I mean, I think speculative fiction, like as a social scientist, I think speculative fiction is really important to take seriously, because yes, it's entertaining, but it can also be very instructive, and it can also be really rich with a commentary. And also, from my perspective, it can provide a blueprint for what is possible. And we've already seen, you know, science fiction and speculative fiction do this. We see the likes of Elon Musk and other people like Mark Zuckerberg citing science fiction. I mean, the metaverse, right? It comes from Snow Crash, Neal Stephenson. many of these ideas and concepts, you know, like Neuralink, they come from science fiction, and the people who are inventing them now or rolling them out are actually very, very consciously connecting this and even broadcasting that connection because of the capital or the interest that creates around and excitement around the technology rollout. For me, speculative fiction provides us a blueprint. It provides us with scenarios. It provides us with possibilities for thinking otherwise. It's not necessarily about predicting the future, but it's about modeling what can be, because if we only have these like very limited visions of what is possible, then we will just end up repeating history again and again, right? And so for me, I'm glad you brought up Tainofuturism, which is a kind of indigenous futurism from the Caribbean, and which is where, you know, my ancestors come from. The idea is to think about how we can both achieve a kind of future of prosperity in a part of the world that has, you know, a long history of struggle, both in terms of the politics of the U.S. and in its relationship to Puerto Rico, but also being in the path of hurricanes that are being exacerbated by climate change. And so how do we deal with that? And for me, in my storytelling, the answer is to looking to the past and looking to the ancestors and looking to them for inspiration for new kinds of technologies and new forms of social and political organization that that chart a new course, something radically different. Is it very likely or possible? Maybe, maybe not. But I think it's still important to have a blueprint, to have a path that you can actually visualize and see.
In the United States, climate science is being eliminated. Even the language of climate science is being wiped away wherever they can scrub it. The new administration is trying to suppress gender expression, and the tech giants who run those farms you monitored have literally taken over the government, and they're appearing as neocolonialists and worse. You just changed from America to Europe. Do you feel like a refugee, Stephen?
I mean, in some ways, yes, but here in Germany, in Deutschland, you know, we do have kind of like in many parts, this sort of troubling rise of the far right, and we do have an election actually next week, so you've caught me at a good time. But, you know, I do think, yeah, in some ways I am grateful to be in Europe. It has been given me a lot of perspective, really, on the U.S. and, you know, the issues there. But I am very concerned about the changes that are this new administration is affecting in the U.S. government. And the few guardrails that we had for these tech companies and really for corporations in general are being swept away at a level that is hard to imagine. I mean, when we're talking about data centers in the cloud and tech companies, they have largely regulated themselves, even under previous administrations. There hasn't been any substantial or significant regulation. The EU, there is, to some degrees, some limitations and differences, especially with respect to the AI Act and privacy concerns. But I think the future in the U.S. now, especially, as you said, climate science is being politicized to the point where it will likely not even be funded. I mean, that is a huge concern, because our ability to map and predict and understand the dynamics of something as complex as the climate is really crucial for our survival, really, and also to be able to anticipate and intervene in what will be really significant changes to our way of life as more hurricanes come, as droughts cycle in, and, you know, extreme weather events of various kinds sweep over the continental U.S. and elsewhere. I think we do have to be prepared for that, and without climate science, I don't see a way that we can address that.
From the Fixing Futures Research Group at Goethe University in Frankfurt, we've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate. You can find links to his paper, The Cloud is Material, on the Environmental Impacts of Computation and Data Storage, and more of his public articles from Stephen, all in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Get the links there. Stephen, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Before we go to the case of burned-out Los Angeles and soil scorching, I want to pass on just a couple of bits of climate news. No one else is going to tell you. News and social media has been consumed by the drama of American politics. Meanwhile, nature continues to change radically as more greenhouse gases pour into the atmosphere every day. First example, so-called zombie fires have taken a new twist. Enormous wildfires in the far north continued burning under the snow in recent years, flaring up again in the spring. Now Canadian fire expert Mike Flanagan, a guest on this program, reports, quote, in 2024, a significant portion of the British Columbia area burned was due to 2023 fires that survived the winter. This is the first time I have seen fires survive two winters in Canada. Friends, are we entering a time of never-ending fires? Number two, new science shows the super greenhouse gas methane, geologic methane this time. Really, it's just natural gas, made in the rocks. It's coming out of the glaciers in Svalbard. Those glaciers are melting fast. It operates similar to fracking for geologic gas and its so-called glacial fracking. Is this happening in fast-disappearing Greenland ice and Antarctica too? This is a whole new frontier of methane emissions. It was never known or counted by scientists or governments when they claimed to plan for climate change. By the way, the high Arctic island of Svalbard, just 700 miles from the North Pole, had a string of days in February this year where it was above freezing. That's never been seen before. This Arctic region is warming 7 times faster than the global average. And as a result of the above-freezing weather, the rain froze into a glassy cover that prevents reindeer from pawing their way down to food this time of year. There could be starvation. And finally, lost in the buzz of Musk madness and war stories, Arctic sea ice is already at a record low again, this time in January, when the ice should be expanding. And that feedback can only strengthen in 2025. Oh yeah, and in a sort of good news department, New Science calculates the new ice age should begin in about 11,000 years. That won't happen, though, because human-generated carbon remains in the atmosphere for over 100,000 years. Cancel one ice age if our species manages to survive that long.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.